tonight. High and Dry Saturday Night, Death Leopard out of the brand new LP. That's the title track. And we're back on the Rock Line with Joe and Steve of Death Leopard. We're going back to the Rock Line phones, and we're going to pick up on Norfolk. And we got Wayne. Go ahead, Wayne, check in. Wayne, are you there?
Hi, Wayne.
Hi, Joe. This is Wayne. We've been sitting around here at WNOR in Norfolk, and I'd like to know, where's Sav Shampoo?
What is this? There's an in thing here. What is going by me here?
I'd just like to announce to God knows how many millions listening that I think this is Rick Allen, our drummer, on the phone.
Oh, Joe, how you doing?
Hi there, Foxy Mama.
Hey, Foxy Mama.
Oh, yeah, you mofo.
Yeah, this is a total in-joke. I don't understand it either.
How you doing, Joe?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good, good. We're doing fine here. You know what, Sav?
Go on, then.
Just hang on there a minute.
He's lost his shampoo.
Now, which one is this that's over there in Norfolk?
Well, now, sir, well, can you run it? Well, we can on new and on, can you?
That's our bass player.
How are you?
You're fired.
For our second album, High and Dry, we employed the talents of Mutt Lange as producer. We tried to get Mutt to do the first album, but he was unavailable. And when we finally managed to nail him down for the second, little did we know what we had in store. We were about to learn what you really had to do to make a good record.
We all kind of knew exactly how why the band should sound without actually knowing how to go about it. And Mutt just came in, and he did become basically a sixth member of the band.
He wasn't satisfied until the sound that he had in his head was, you know, was coming out of the speakers.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and this is episode 2 about Def Leppard. I'm going to do a series of episodes here, one for each album. Last week I talked to Joe Royland about On Through the Night, and this week my special guest is Julian Gill, who literally wrote the book on the band. Not only, you're also, what, the moderator of the KISS FAQ website, host of the KISS FAQ podcast, author of many awesome books about KISS as well that I own, and also I love this book that you wrote called Leopard Tracks. What year did that book come out?
That came out in 2008, and it was a total bomb.
Yeah, right. Well, I bought it.
you know. Thank you very much. I'll put the check in the post.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm such a huge Def Leppard fan, and there, you know, the thing is, there aren't any books about them. There's not like a great Def Leppard biography out there, which is really unfortunate. Your book is, I mean, there's a lot of bio in there, but it's much more of like a track by track and a tour history and that kind of thing. I would really love to read like a really well written, just straight up Def Leppard biography, you know?
Yeah, and that's one of the things that's really missing for this band. I mean, obviously they made a little bit of an effort back in 86, 87, you know, to put out kind of the biography on their point of view, like all the bands were doing at the time. So it was a gap. And being a KISS fan, obviously, we have Behind the Makeup and KISS Alive Forever. So I took those two kind of, you know, operating methodologies and tried to merge them into one thing with the Leopard Tracks book. And, you know, for some people it kind of worked, but for most people it was really a little bit too schizophrenic.
There's a lot of great info in there, and I love reading, you know, track by track with little tidbits about each song. I love looking at tour dates and seeing the bands they open with and just different things that happened on different shows, and, you know, looking when they came through my town when I was 5 years old. I'm really into all that kind of stuff. So it's a really fun book. Yes. So today we're going to talk about their second album, High and Dry, which is almost universally, well, it's definitely seems like the majority of Def Leppard fans list this as their favorite, or definitely like the hardcore Def Leppard fans. It seems to be a real fan favorite. It's my favorite. And I gave you your choice of which album you wanted to come on and talk about, and you picked this one, so it seems like it must be your favorite as well, correct?
Yeah, I didn't even have to think about the answer of which Def Leppard album I'd like to pontificate about. High and Dry by far has always been my favorite Def Leppard album since the day I discovered it and first heard it.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite albums of all time. It's pretty much the exact kind of music that is my favorite kind of music, and I guess really Def Leppard probably played a big role in shaping my taste in music since they were one of the first bands that I really got into, and you know, just my entire life I've been a huge Def Leppard fan, and yeah, my love for this record has never waned at all over the years. When I talked to Joe Roiland about On Through the Night, we talked a lot about how, well, for one thing, it was written and recorded by teenagers, or you know, barely out of their teens by the time they recorded it. You can hear sort of the inexperience. You can hear it's the first songs they ever wrote. It's a great album, but we talked about how more than anything with On Through the Night, you hear their ambition, how ambitious they were. You hear the potential that they had. And so High and Dry, it really does sound like a completely different band, because very quickly it seems they found themselves, they found their own sound. And to me, the perfect way to describe High and Dry is confident. They just sound so confident with what they're doing, and they're just doing it so well. And really, the contrast between this record and On Through the Night is really dramatic. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, without a doubt, it's a quantum leap from On Through the Night. And just to think that they're all grown up at this point. I mean, Rick Allen's turned 18 years old.
Right.
on High and Dry. So here we are comparing, you know, a 16-year-old versus an 18-year-old in terms of the music. But just the sonic attack, I mean, it's just so far apart from where they were for that first album that it's quite amazing the amount of growth that there was in that very short period of time that they hit the road, really.
Yeah, On Through the Night, I think their influences really bleed through a lot. And High and Dry, you know, it's just their own thing. They've kind of left that behind and just come into their own and figured out exactly what Def Leppard is. And it's amazing. And obviously the change in producer obviously was also a huge factor in this as well. So High and Dry was recorded, what, March to June of 1981 and released in July of 1981. I think that's funny how it worked back then. You know, they finished recording it in June, comes out in July, right?
Yeah, there was no sitting around waiting for it to, ripen any further. It's get it out the door, get that product out there. So there's no waiting around. That's probably what makes it so fresh.
Yeah. And, they were under the new management of Peter Mensch, Cliff Bernstein, who also managed AC/DC, correct? So, and Mutt Lange's coming off of producing Highway to Hell. Like you say in your book that they had to wait for Mutt to finish producing Foreigner 4, right, before they could go into the studio with him?
Yeah, that's right. They were waiting on Mutt to free up time. So they'd finished up their On Through the Night tour, and they did a little mini tour in the UK in December 1980 while they're passing time. So they're playing some of the material out there. Probably none of those circulate as bootlegs, which is such a crying shame. But they're working their material and just getting ready to hit the studio. And they're probably rehearsing a lot, so they're about to get a real producer, a big name who's come off, you know, Back in Black. They toured with AC/DC those few shows.
Right.
So they knew exactly who they were going in with and what he could do for a band. I mean, just the transformation for AC/DC between Highway to Hell and Back in Black, I mean, that's another quantum leap for a band. So they would have been quite inspired knowing that they were going to get to work with this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, and so definitely, I guess that's got to be, we're talking about how different the two records sound, and obviously Mutt Lange was also a big factor in that, but how much do you think Mutt Lange had to do with actually writing any of this material?
I think he's got his fingerprints all over this material.
Yeah.
And Rick Savage has, you know, admitted that and he wasn't shy about it. It wasn't like he was letting away some big, gigantic secret that Mutt had made suggestions all over the place in the material. Well, not necessarily all over the place, but in the important parts where Mutt is so good at refining the material without it getting to the level where he gets his name on any of the songs as a credit. So he's there. He's probably helping them with the arrangements. He's saying, no, you don't need that extra verse, that extra, you know, narrow it down. Exactly the sort of thing he did with so many other bands. So he's the editing machine.
Right. Yeah, and the quality of the arrangements on this record really stands out too, and just all the great harmonies as well, which has always been a big Mutt Lange, a big element of Mutt Lange produced albums is, you know, lots of harmonies, lots of background vocals and stuff. So all of that is very apparent on this record. I talked last week about On Through the Night. Me and Joe Royland talked about how when that record came out, a lot of like the hardcore, the new wave of British heavy metal fans, like fans of Def Leppard from the club days, they were already talking about how Def Leppard were a sellout right away on their first record. Even though the album was produced by Tom Allom, who, you know, was already well known for producing Black Sabbath and Judas Priest, and yet a lot of criticism, I think, from the heavy metal community, at least, of the production on that record, right?
Well, the production's what kills that album, and the material. You have to kind of also look at it that, yeah, those were the 15, 16-year-old kids who wrote all that material. What perspective does a kid that age have to really write a song other than perhaps thinking about getting laid and drunk? So there's not a whole lot of musical or life experience that goes into the music. But the production, if you take the other big new wave of British heavy metal band, Iron Maiden, their debut also suffered production-wise. So yeah. What were two bands that were pretty raw, pretty loose, aggressive, did not translate onto the vinyl. And for me, that's what really kind of muddies On Through the Night, that it's decent material. It's a bit nondescript in terms of the story. And then, of course, they make the mistake of coming out and putting Hello America out as a single, which just sends the wrong message to the British crowd.
Yeah. Yeah, I think On Through the Night, they didn't quite meet their aspirations, so to speak. They had lofty goals with that record, maybe almost at times a little bit pretentious. And that's one thing you would never even consider saying about High and Dry is pretentious.
Oh, it's a word you can't even use on the same page as High and Dry.
Right. And also, you know, High and Dry isn't about like aspirations. It's just about confidence and just, this is us, you know, check this out. There's just, I think a perfect word to describe it is just confident. You just hear the confidence all over this thing. There's no second guessing themselves. They just know exactly what they're doing, and they just do it so well.
Yes, and they've got some more life experiences now, some real life experiences to sing about. They're not in the Spoon Factory in Sheffield anymore. They're not touring around, you know, dinky little pubs in Northern England. They've been to America. They've been on tour with big major acts like Priest, AC/DC again. Who else they were out with? Scorpions,
you know? Yeah.
And I think Joe Perry Project as well for some shows. Or that actually comes, I think, with this tour. So they've been touring. They've been on the road. They've been living the road. So now they're still singing about the same sorts of things as they were as 16-year-olds, but they've got a little bit of legitimate experience to go with those songs.
So should we just jump into song by song here and talk about each song on the record? Oh,
absolutely. Let's go.
So the album kicks off with Let It Go, which, you know, holy shit. Killer riff. I love it so much. Great. Like, the verse kind of starts off mellow and just the way it builds. I love the way it builds. I wrote down it goes from ominous to menacing to aggressive. They just keep kind of stepping it up, you know, for over the course of the verse into the chorus. And it's just such a kick-ass rock song with such a great chorus that just rides the riff. I love the way these songs ride the riff so well. The melody and the riff complement each other so well in these songs. You know, I know the band don't really like to think of themselves as a heavy metal band, but to me, this is absolutely a heavy metal album. But it's also just great rock and roll as well. You know, you don't necessarily have to put it in a heavy metal box because this is just a great rock song.
Yeah, this is a band reacting to every complaint about their first album. in, you know, zero to angry in 3.2 seconds, because it's just a guitar attack. Everything that made the classic bands and their dual guitar attack, this is Pete Willis and Stephen Clark just absolutely bouncing off one another in perfection. For me, this leadoff track is one of the greatest of any album ever for me. You know, in my personal catalog of favorites, it's just how it doesn't slowly work you into the album saying, you know, this is us and our second album. It grabs you by the ears and shakes your head.
Yeah. And right away, this barely even resembles On Through the Night.
Oh, it's a complete antithesis of On Through the Night. And what's so funny is that they've been playing this song in a different form, you know, going back to club shows in London in April 1980. So it had had a long time to gestate. And I think it was called
When the Rain Falls, I think it says in your book. Yeah.
Yeah, that's right, what it was referred to. So they had played this quite a bit throughout 1980. And it was one of the ones that, you know, gets the full treatment. And it seemed very fitting, really, when you go back and look at the history of the band with On Through the Night, and the April tour was really kind of the breakout tour for Britain. It was their first major headlining tour on their own, you know. So it has a good history when you take that song and then make it the lead-off track. And who were they on the road with in April 80? I think Magnum and Tigers of Pan Tang or something. So, you know, it's just a great way to open the album. It's a declaration of where things are going on this album. Okay, so moving on to track number two, another hit and run, which even more pronounced kind of soft, loud dynamic on this one than on the first song. But to me, both of these songs have a similar feel, and they really go together as just a great opening pair of songs. And, you know, great melodic guitar on this song. And really, I love how it gets real quiet and then just blasts, just kicks in. Great bridge, that You Got No Respect part, love it. Joe Elliott is so great on these songs, and you know, these two opening songs are two of my favorite songs ever, and just listening to them together, they just go together so well. Just a masterpiece of a song. You know, I've sung the praises of the guitar work of Pete and Steve on this, but it's really, you've heard Joe say how he's so happy that the band stuck with him long enough that he learned how to sing.
Right.
But here's the thing. I think he absolutely delivers a performance on this album, even if he isn't a great technical singer at this point. You know, he's grown from what he was on the first album, and he's rough around the edges, but it's the raw, you know, just the emotion, the anger, the attitude, you know, probably attitude more than anger, because you never think of Def Leppard as an angry music band. So, you know, it's just got a great attitude and swagger to it, and combine it with the first song and it's a 1-2 punch. I mean, it's like pure Mike Tyson.
Yeah, exactly. And I, you do hear some anger, or at least some aggression, especially in these first two songs. Or like I was saying, just pure confidence in what they're doing. And Joe Elliott just comes across as incredibly confident on these songs. And yeah, he's amazing on here. I love what he's doing.
Yeah, and when you have a confident start, you know, it doesn't really matter what they're thinking. They're making a declaration here that this is us, this is where we're going. You know, get along for the ride or get off. Simple as that. Come with us. And if you're not going to get hooked by this song, I mean, how many hooks? It's just hooks galore going on. You know, these songs that it's impossible for me as a listener to not get fully engaged. I, you know, if I make it into this album, by this track, there's no way I'm walking away to do something else. Simple as that. I'm here for the rest of the album.
Yeah, right. I think you talk in your book about how this record was not a success at all in the UK, right?
They weren't a success in the UK for many years. Yeah, it's kind of boggles the mind in terms of so many of the bands that did take off in the period and the sort of music that was going on. But they were the poster boys for, you know, success hate. That is such a popular thing for the British, that once you make it, which getting a record deal for a band is kind of seen as making it, that your fans or your popular support turns on you because now you're a successful ponce.
Do you think that if this had come out as their first album instead of On Through the Night, that maybe they would have had a completely different career trajectory, just because they wouldn't have had that backlash that they had with the first record?
No, I don't think a young band like Def Leppard could avoid the backlash, because they were young, they were cocky, and they were successful. Again, you know, once you've got that success, people hate you for it sometimes. And they were just, you know, they were never apologetic for being successful. They were never afraid to walk away from England either, which, look where they made their career for the most part,
right,
before having any success in the UK. So it's a strange thing, but very British, you know. create something big and go and have success elsewhere.
Right, so the third song on the record is the title track. Well, and we didn't talk about the album cover, which is a Hypnosis design. I don't know. How do you feel about the album cover? The guy diving into the pool.
It's kind of artistic. It doesn't make any sense to me. It doesn't tell a story. It doesn't go with the title. So it's just something to put the LP in, or, you know, CD cover, whatever. It doesn't matter.
And you've got these guys that are looking up on the front and then looking down on the back, and it's just like maybe three or four guys that are just they're turned into a crowd, but they just have different looks on their faces, it seems like. But I think they did that on purpose to just be weird. It's just one of those weird Hypnosis things, I guess.
For whoever does write the definitive book on Def Leppard, I think this album cover is worth a chapter in itself. Interviews with the artist, the band, with a big WTF and a question mark at the end of it.
Yeah, and I guess, but On Through the Night's probably even a bigger WTF.
Well, that at least makes a little bit more sense than High and Dry.
If you say so. The semi in outer space. I really do like the pictures of the band on the back, though. I don't know why three of the five guys aren't wearing shirts. You'd think maybe they would have just all gone shirtless or had some kind of a theme. But
well, then it gets a bit scary and heads into the realm of Manowar.
Yeah. And the guys on the back, when they're looking down, they're all smiling. It's like, is the pool empty? There's no water in the pool? So they watch this guy dive headfirst into an empty pool, and then they're smiling at the end. I guess that's what's going on there.
No, you know, maybe it's a message to the British fans. You know, you left us high and dry. Here's our response to that.
Yeah, I guess he was on the high dive and the pool was dry. I guess that's the high and dry part. But obviously that's not what the song High and Dry is about. You know, this song is just kind of a, I wrote down it has a lazy, sleazy vibe that fits the subject matter, I suppose. I don't like it as much as the first two songs. I think it's the verse doesn't quite work as well for me, but the bridge and the chorus are great. A great sing-along chorus and a great solo section. So it's a great song, but it's not as good as the first two.
No, and that's the same for me. You know, it's actually one of my least favorite Leppard songs. It just doesn't do a whole lot. What I do like is how they explain the story of the song, which was partying with the Scorpions and just having like a alcoholic-fueled hijacking of a taxi. So this song's representative of all the hijinks on the road. So you kind of get a better feel for it. You know, it's just insanity. But it feels the least polished of, you know, the first three that we've listened to. Like, there's just something missing from it that would take it up to the next level or bring it to a similar level of the first two songs.
Yeah, it's not as sophisticated an arrangement. I think for me it's just the verse. I think the chorus is awesome, but I think the verse definitely doesn't live up to the quality of most of the rest of the songs in the album. When you just put this record on and listen to it straight through, you don't want to skip this one or anything like that. So moving on to the next song, Bringing On the Heartbreak. Maybe I should let you start the discussion of some of these songs so I don't get to say everything, right?
Well, here we go with what is the ubiquitous power ballad, I guess. And it's kind of interesting that they are attempting to write something touching and, I guess, you know, a little bit broader. And surprisingly, it stands the test of time very well. I was listening to the album, you know, right before we started talking this morning, and I was like, you know, that's cute. And it is cute. It's not as bad or as cheesy as it could have been when you remember the age of these guys and, again, the life experience. So I think it's a pretty fun song, and it's a nice little change of pace after three high-octane songs. So, you know, more power to them. You know, still shows up now and then, and it's a good song.
Yeah, you say in your book that they almost left this one off the record and that Cliff Bernstein actually thought about shopping it to other artists to see if somebody else might like to record it.
Yeah, I think that it was like Bonnie Tyler. And yeah, I can just see that.
Oh,
well.
Yeah.
You know, she in that time, she could totally have nailed this song. But I think it also takes someone, you know, like your management, to say, hey, no, leave it on. Don't get rid of it, because it gives you a different texture. It shows that you're not one-dimensional. It shows, you know, that you're maturing as an artist, that you're developing. And it gives you, I mean, come on, as Kiss fans, you go back to Beth. It gives you the kind of, this is different, and who knows what could happen with it being different. It might come in handy.
Yeah, I think this is a great heavy metal ballad with a great melody, and I wrote down that it's not corny or cheesy. It doesn't feel that way to me. It's really well written, great production, great build into the chorus, great harmonies, you know, all those Mutt Lange elements. It's not, you know, it's not my favorite song on the record. It's not a song that I'm just gonna say, oh, I want to listen to Bring It On the Heartbreak and just go listen to this song. But it's a great song, it's a great production. And yeah, and you know, it's a ballad, but it's not. There's also a lot of elements of hard rock or heavy metal in there, so it doesn't stand out really as like a. It fits with the album still.
Oh yeah, it's not sappy. It's not syrupy.
Yeah.
It's not weak in any sense. It fits perfectly with the album in terms of kind of the structure and the style. It's still got the power that comes through it in parts. You know, it's wonderfully produced. Simple as that. You know,
yeah.
They did a great job recording it. It sounds perfect. You know, there's nothing I'd do to improve it. Obviously, they didn't feel that since they did make changes to it later. But, you know, great song. Complete Failure is a single.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. Is that to me, it's pretty mind-blowing that this was not a hit single. It's kind of crazy, really. And it really stood out at the time as a different kind of a song from a band like this, and seems tailor-made to be a hit.
I think like that, it's And I don't know if we'll talk about the remixes later, but it's kind of ahead of its time in some ways, and that becomes right. more evident in 1984.
Yeah, exactly. I know when I was growing up on the local radio stations in Milwaukee, when they would play Bringin' On the Heartbreak, they would just play straight through and play the next song as well, Switch 625, which you say in your book there was a mock-up of the album cover, and I guess they Hypnosis, when they made a cover to show the band, I guess to pitch the idea or something, they just made up some song titles. And there was a song in there called Switch, and it said it was 6 minutes 25 seconds, right? So that's how they named this instrumental, correct?
Yeah, just a made-up song, because obviously Switch 625 is not 6 minutes and 25
yeah. seconds. That's a great story for how it got the name. I love that. And I'm not usually a big fan of instrumentals. I'm much more a fan of songs and the melodies of songs and stuff, but this is a very melodic instrumental, and they kind of cheat a little bit because there are some vocal parts, just no lyrics. But I wrote down that it kind of reminds me of that the part with the vocals kind of reminds me of Flash Gordon, Queen's theme for Flash Gordon.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those songs that I actually always look forward to it. I'm listening to Bringin' On the Heartbreak, and I'm like, ooh, it's coming, it's coming, it's coming. Yeah, it's just a really fun instrumental. There's nothing, you know. It doesn't take you on a journey. It just builds and builds and builds and brings the first side of the album to a crescendo. So I love it. And I absolutely was thrilled when, they've included it on Viva Hysteria as one of those songs. I just get really excited whenever I see them getting ready to play it, you know, and they still do a fantastic job of it in concert. And it's not like an instrumental of, oh, we couldn't figure out any words for it.
Right.
It's something that has a purpose. It seems like it belongs. It seems that it doesn't need any words. It's not like one of those instrumentals where you're like, well, you could have come up with something here. I'm hearing words in my head. You don't. It's saying it all musically.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. We'll be right back. So then flip the record over and we get to side two of High and Dry, which is an amazing thing. Kicks off with a song called You Got Me Running, which I've always loved this song. It's just kind of a simple pop metal song, but it has a great groove, awesome chorus. So it's always been a favorite of mine. It's just a fun sing-along song with great hooks, which, you know, that's all I really want usually. So,
yeah, it's one of those songs that just feels like it's been trimmed back to the barest elements needed and doesn't have any extra fat on it.
Yeah,
it's a good way to start the second side. I don't think it's quite as strong as, you know, the punch you get on the first side, but I don't think it's weak either.
Yeah, no. Yeah, it's not as good as Let It Go, Another Hit and Run, those songs. It's not as good as a couple more coming up on side two, but I've always loved it. It works for me. It's the exact kind of song I enjoy, so...
I was doing the book, this is one of the songs I could not find, you know, any direct quotes of them talking about this one and creating, and that's kind of, you know, it's kind of nondescript in that way that they haven't really spoken about it, even going back to 80 81 82, that, you know, they're not talking about the song much, so it becomes a little bit anonymous, and that's how it feels on the album here.
Yeah, sort of. I guess it's kind of weird that they put it as the first song on side two. It probably would have made more sense, really, to flip it with the next song. You want to start us off talking about Lady Strange?
Love Lady Strange. Again, that's one of the songs that go back to the 1980 tour. They're working this one on the, I believe it's the US leg, so May 1980. This is in the set. This is one that I think goes all the way up through Reading. As yeah, they did it in Reading.
We'll be right back.
So it's a very road-tested song. And it's, again, it shows the growth of the band. All of a sudden, you got this separation between that early material and the new material. And this is just a really strong piece that's gone through the road testing, the editing, and being touched by the finger of Mutt.
And we talked about how You Got Me Running is kind of simple and nondescript. But this song is a really complex arrangement. And yeah, it does sound road tested. And it's so melodic, and the breakdown before the solo, like the really heavy breakdown part, and the solo section is amazing. All the solo sections on these songs are amazing. But I wrote down that this song is just all melody. There's just so much melody going on here. I think it would have made a lot more sense to flip it and put this song as the first song on side two. I think that would have worked better.
Yeah, I'm not sure if it's got the strength to lead off a track with how melodic it is. You know, it's very mature.
And right,
I think,
right.
I think it's probably one of the most mature tracks on the album that really shows them growing as artists, as writers, as creators. So, yeah, I always thought that the track we'll talk about next should have been the lead off for side two.
Okay, you want to talk about that one?
Yeah, the title track of the previous album.
Yeah.
I always got a kick out of, you know, whoa, why did they put a song called that on this album? And never made any sense to me. But again, this is one of my favorite songs on the album. It's just really fun rock and roll. And again, it pounds. It kind of tells us a tale of the road. And it sums up where they're at. So I would have loved to, you know, I think it goes better in the sequence for me personally as the lead off. But it doesn't need to make any sense whatsoever since it's the title track of the previous album.
Yeah, right. Yeah, well, when me and Joe were talking last week about the first album, when we mentioned that the title track ended up on the next album, and then we were saying, I wonder if, you know, if they had that when they recorded the first album. But then when I pulled your book out to refresh my memory, you say in there that they did not have this song when they made the first record, correct?
That was my understanding from how I read into what Steve had said about the track, that it sounded like a good title when they came up with that for the first album, that they should have written a song. But obviously they had a full catalog of material for that first album, so they didn't have the song then. He wrote it later.
I think there's a great arrangement on this song, but I definitely like the verse more than the chorus, and I think maybe the chorus does feel a little bit shoehorned in, like they had the song and then they were like, hey, we could use On Through the Night for this, but it wasn't written. It didn't flow necessarily. They just kind of used that title. So I think that might be part of the reason why the chorus doesn't quite work as well for me. I think the verse has a stronger melody.
But yeah, that's an interesting point, that maybe it's a little bit forced, that it's been, you know, shoehorned like you put. So, yeah, something to think about.
Moving on to the next song, the fourth song on side two. I know when I first had the idea of doing some episodes about Def Leppard, I put on the Facebook page for the podcast, I just asked, what's your favorite Def Leppard song? And this song got mentioned by quite a few people. A song called Mirror, Mirror, which to me, this is just unbelievable songwriting. What a riff. And I was thinking, just thinking of the time period, there wasn't really anything else like this song at the time, I don't think. The chorus is insanely great. Definitely one of the best songs the band ever wrote, from my point of view. And like I'm saying, a fan favorite for sure. The arrangement is just brilliant. And the dynamic of the song, and just the way a lot of the songs in this record have a great build, you know, and but when it really kicks in, it's just goosebumps, you know, and yeah, so I mean, it doesn't get much better than this song, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I'm not surprised at all by the amount of love this song gets. It is scary good.
Yeah.
Again, we were talking about the maturity and the songcraft with something like Bring On the Heartbreak. This is the same. It is scary good how well constructed and executed this song is. It is absolutely unbelievable. And it rightfully gets those high marks from people.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote down, it's skillfully crafted and precisely delivered. It's just a great work of art.
I have nothing else to say. You said it all with that.
Yeah.
We have a song on the new album, which is a battle between a man and a mirror. This is called Mirror, Mirror, Look Into My Eyes.
Thank you.
And then we have the last song on the album, No, 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 which is, you know, it's a cool driving rocker. I wrote down this maybe is the song on the record that's the most similar to On Through the Night, to like maybe a Roxoff or Answer to the Master type song, maybe. Probably my least favorite song on the record, but it's still a cool song. It's just a cool rock song, but, you know, if you're comparing it to most of the rest of the songs on the album, it doesn't measure up from my point of view.
Yeah, if there's one song on the album that leans deeply into the realm that would be called filler, this one is it. And in some ways, it feels like trying too hard to finish as they started. So Let It Go, insanely strong. And they're just trying to maybe get that same energy over to conclude the album, finishing with one more punch in the gut. And it just doesn't quite come off. And maybe it's just because I don't like songs called No, No, No by any band.
I like this song. It's a cool song. It's just, you know, when you're going to, it's coming after Mirror, Mirror. So, you know, come on. It's kind of, you know, that kind of hamstrings it a little bit. But
that's the fun point to make with this album. The bar is so high that yeah. even a weak track is at a pretty, you know, pretty good level to be criticizing it as being, you know, close to filler for this album. Well, you know, there are a lot of bands that would kill to have a song like No, 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 and the energy and the execution, again, the sound of it, you know, it fits perfectly with the album. You can tell it belongs here, but it's just, you know, a pinch away from the rest of the material.
Yeah. And it sounds like they're having a ton of fun on this song too, which, you know, always helps. When you could tell the band's having fun and enjoying what they're doing, which I definitely think comes through on this song. It must have been. I'm kind of, now that I'm thinking about it, I'm kind of surprised that this hasn't like stayed in their live set, because it seems like one of those songs that would be really fun to play live.
Yeah, I don't think it'd be very good for Joe these days.
Yeah, probably not.
But that's the other thing about the album. You know, we go through all of these songs individually, and maybe we lose track of overall, it's just a party. The whole album is just fun and youth and excitement and execution. I don't feel any stress on this album. It's impossible to. You know, you're not going to get high blood pressure listening to it. No way. You're just going to be sitting there like I often do with an inane grin on my face, remembering being 14 years old or remembering being immortal when you're 18, like the life these guys were living at the time. It doesn't sound like it was a grind to create any of these songs. The ones, you know, that maybe didn't make it all the way, you know, like On Through the Night or No, 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 they're like, whatever, you know, they're not worried about them. They're just, you know, they're just hitting record, playing, not overthinking, not trying to be something that they're not. And that really comes across to me on the album, the energy, the, you know, the fun. It's just a fun record.
These guys in this band are huge music fans themselves, which always helps. I always seem to appreciate a band more when the guys in the band love music as much as I do. And they're as big a fan as I am of Def Leppard. The guys in Def Leppard are just the same way, you know, with their favorite bands. And so they have such an appreciation for what they're doing. And, you know, it's something that they really love to do. And yeah, you really hear that on this record, that they love it. And it's just like every goal they have in their life is just to make High and Dry. That's what they want to do with their lives. And not just to for fame or money, but just because they love music and they love making it. And yeah, so that really helps the appreciation, I think, of an album like this.
Yeah, and they want to craft the same sort of quality material, you know, with the catchy hooks, you know, the crisp and clear guitar of their influences. And of all the bands that I've liked, I've always felt that Def Leppard had some of the greatest influences. And you still hear about it. And a lot of it goes into the glam era, which, you know, again, just makes you smile. But that glam material, it was short, it was catchy, it was concise, and they really brought that to the harder metal sound that they were exploring at this time. So, you know, thank goodness for their influences, because out of my personal journey with Def Leppard, I got to go a long way into other music because of them talking about their love of music.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm a huge Slater, one of my favorite bands ever. And I'm a huge fan of all that UK glam that Def Leppard were huge fans of, you know, Sweet, Mott the Hoople, all that stuff. Yeah. And so, yeah, they don't sound like those bands, but they incorporate elements of that. And there weren't a lot of other bands that you would have called heavy metal at the time that were incorporating something like Mott the Hoople into their music. So yeah, that was a big element of it.
Yeah, and once you get to High and Dry, they're not mimicking now. Now you really get to see a Def Leppard emerging. You know, again, it comes back to them growing up. They're no longer kind of one note, which is what a lot of the material on Through the Night was. You could kind of see the inspiration. You could kind of see the influences more transparently. Now they're becoming more of themselves and being able to express it with the maturity that's come along. So they're able to think it, create it, express it, and with a producer like Mutt behind the board, capture it.
Right. And yeah, like you were saying, this is just such a cohesive record where it's so, as instead of just picking out individual songs from High and Dry, you just think of High and Dry as a whole and just as a great album. And, you know, for me, there aren't a lot of albums where there isn't at least one, aren't at least one or two songs that I would skip. And there are a lot of records where, you know, maybe there's only half the songs that I'm really a huge fan of. So to find the record where just all the way through, it just kicks total ass and you just love it all the way through it. Don't even think of any individual songs. It's just the whole piece of work as a whole. That's one of the things that's so great about this album.
Yeah, and these songs belong together. When again, comparing the previous album, that's a collection of songs. That right. is, you know, everything we've done to now, the best of put together. This seems it's a unit. It is one. It's they can't exist separately. They don't belong elsewhere. They are, you know, all part of the same creature. So, you know, it's more than an album. It's, you know, it's an experience. It's exactly what you want out of, what is it, 30-something minutes of, well, 42 minutes, pardon me.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, of course, going into the next album, they make another sort of quantum leap. And I kind of lament the fact that they didn't explore the High and Dry version of Def Leppard maybe with at least one more album before they took such another big jump. I would have loved to hear another record. You know, maybe there should have been another record between High and Dry and Pyromania that kind of bridged the gap, and that would have been an awesome album, you know, if it existed.
Yeah, that's an interesting point too. You know, obviously you'll talk in depth about Pyromania in your next episode, but that was my first Def Leppard album. I mean, going back to 1983, it's like heavy metal. It was impossible to not discover. So, you know, Def Leppard and Quiet Riot. Pyromania, for me, doesn't come anywhere near being as good as High and Dry. The material is still strong, but what would make Pyromania perfect for me is if the drums sounded like the drums do on High and Dry. And what they did to Rick on that album, nah. that just kills the Sonics for me. It doesn't have the sonic glory that High and Dry has. It doesn't have the just the expressiveness of the music, the clarity of the instruments, the separation of those instruments so that you can actually focus on the other parts. And that's what High and Dry has that makes it, you know, the best Def Leppard album for me. You can hear everything. There are so many nuances. Stick on, listen to it with headphones, you hear new things. Yeah, every experience, you know, even 35 years later is, you know, still a new listening experience. It feels as fresh as the first time I heard it.
Yeah, I love Pyromania, but yeah, the production on High and Dry is way better. I love how High and Dry sounds. It definitely sounds, to my ears, to what I like, it's way better sound than Pyromania. And as much as I like Pyromania, you're also kind of mourning the loss of the band that made High and Dry, really. And so, you know, I guess you want the best of both worlds, maybe. But yeah, it's. I just think it's too bad that they left the band that made High and Dry. They left that behind so quickly, and too bad they didn't explore it a little bit more.
Yeah, and Mutt had such a short period, really, where he really dialed in the studios. You listen to Back in Black, that is one of the best-sounding rock albums of all time. No doubt about it. This album, crystal clear, absolutely perfectly, you know, produced. It is, the studio setup is absolutely stunning. And then with Pyromania, they take a step back from that sound. It's almost like the difference in sonics between Highway to Hell and Back in Black in reverse, that you now have High and Dry being an absolutely incredible sounding record, and he's gone back to the settings he was using for Highway to Hell. So maybe that's just something I pick up on, or, you know, in my twisted mind, but it always felt like this was the height of his kind of period where he was absolutely capturing the clarity of the musicians perfectly.
Yeah, I completely agree with what you said, which is that High and Dry is perfectly produced. It really is. There's just like no complaint to be made. Yeah, I guess that's another thing that makes the record so great, is there's just really no complaint. There's nothing to complain about. The only things to rave about. So I guess we could talk about that. I guess, you know, when Pyromania is a big hit, they reissue the album and they have a remix. So there's actually two versions of Bringing On the Heartbreak on that record. And then they add the song Me and My Wine, which it's not a great song. It's all right. They even had a video on MTV for that song. What is the story on that song?
Well, Me and My Wine was originally a B-side. You know, where they had Good Morning Freedom on the first album.
Right, right.
They had Me and My Wine on, I think it was the B-side to Bring On the Heartbreak. So they had also performed that in Reading. It had been in the set going back into mid-1980, or, you know, into the summer of 1980. So it was part of the set. Why it was left off the album, who knows, probably for the same reason that Good Morning Freedom wasn't included on the album, that they wanted to have a B-side. So 84 comes around, and this is what I alluded to a little bit earlier when I said that Bring On the Heartbreak was probably a little bit ahead of its time, because when it's reissued in 84, in that gap between Pyromania being released and them waiting on what they were going to hope to be the next album, which obviously never happened.
Yeah.
You know, then it hits the charts. I mean, I think it gets to 61. It gets a video. It's getting rotation on MTV. They've added in the keyboards. They've softened it up for kind of the crossover market. And I just remember seeing that thing on the on MTV continuously at that time. I mean, you could count on turning on MTV and seeing Def Leppard, Twisted Sister, or Quiet Riot. I mean, it simply was that. And Me and My Wine, I mean, you know, that's a throwaway track without a doubt.
Yeah, you're right. They played Bring It On the Heartbreak constantly on MTV, and even in the wake of Pyromania, it still wasn't like a huge hit single, which is just kind of mind-boggling. But you know, and it got a lot of airplay. It definitely got a lot of radio play too. And it's definitely one of those songs that that everybody knows now, but you look back and it didn't really chart very high, but it's still, you know, it's a classic song that's definitely well known at this point.
Yeah, it benefits more from the post-Pyromania hysteria, pardon the pun, but you know, it still doesn't get the recognition that I think we both think it deserves. You know, it was good that it got released. I just don't think they needed to fiddle around with it too much.
Right. And so, of course, after High and Dry, I mean, another, you know, there's the whole everything that's going on with Pete Willis, which I wish I knew more about. Like, you reference in your book a lot, you reference Rudy Sarzo's book, because Def Leppard were on tour with the Ozzy Osbourne band, and he tells some stories in there about Pete Willis and his drinking problem. So it was already pretty, I guess, on the tour between High and Dry and Pyromania, it was already starting to become a pretty big issue.
It already was a big issue. I mean, Rudy is pretty, you know, straightforward in how he explains that Pete was so wasted he was shouting at buildings, arguing with walls. You know, and that's a really sad sign of someone who's struggling with his circumstances and you know, struggling with substances. So you know, Rudy's book was called Off the Rails, and it's well worth a read, but you know, it's also a very sad read when you kind of experienced the self-destruction firsthand. And it was such a crying shame. I always thought Pete Willis was an absolutely incredible guitarist, and he and Steve were just a perfect foil for each other, something that they totally lost once Pete departed the band. You know, he was just unpredictable musically and unpredictable, I guess, with a bit of beer in him.
Yeah. Yeah. I watched an interview on YouTube where Pete Willis said it's probably the best thing that ever happened to him, getting kicked out of the band, I guess because it woke him up. You know, maybe he thinks he wouldn't even be alive at this point if he had stayed in the band, especially considering what happened to Steve Clark. But it's definitely not the best thing that ever happened to Def Leppard.
No, I think creatively it turns, you know, it completely takes a left turn for the band once they lose him, because he's so central to all of this early material, whether it's involved in the writing, whether it's involved in the creation, or, you know, playing of the guitar. But I think he would have been dead, you know, if he'd stayed in the band. And right. he's the one in-depth interview I would really, really love to see someone do. You know, the long sit down with him where, you know, maybe he's willing to talk about a lot of his career, this album in particular. I don't want to talk to him or hear him, you know, necessarily talk about Pyromania and the negativity that surrounds that period for him. But I'd love to hear him talk about the early era of Leppard, and then, you know, Roadhouse, which is another one of my favorite kind of melodic type bands that he was somewhat involved with later.
Yeah. Yeah. I've thought about trying to have him on the podcast to do just that. And there is a Facebook page, but it's one of those things where he's obviously hasn't even looked at it in years. I think I sent the message to it, but I don't really know how else to try to get in touch with him.
Yeah, I tried to track him down for the book. You know, I've tried a few times when I've been back in England, since I'm up in the north when I'm there. You know, my impression is that, you know, at least at the times I made approaches, that he doesn't want to talk. I mean, it's,
yeah.
Again, we're going to, you know, touch a little bit on a Kiss side story, you know, a little bit like Vinnie Vincent, you know, reclusive, has moved on in a different place now from all of this. And maybe it would be painful for him to recount knowing what the band went on to do that he was the foundation of. I mean, he was very much a part of the foundation that set the band up for an impressive 35 plus year career now.
I do have to say, I was thinking it's kind of odd that when you look at how the band approached the Rick Allen situation when he lost his arm, it's you wonder why Pete Willis didn't get the same consideration. Maybe instead of just kicking him out, they tried to get him help. Said, you know, we can, the way they dealt with their drummer losing an arm, maybe they could have tried to deal with their guitar player and his drinking problem. Because obviously, if you're going to keep a one-armed drummer in your band, that's a much bigger leap than trying to help your guitar player with his alcohol problem, right?
Right, but he must have been a really nasty little drunk, though.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and of course, Rick was the wee baby of the band. You know, I mean, he's just a wee laddie for many years. So when he loses his arm at 21, you know, regardless of the circumstances, which you know are quite sad. You know, it's easier to stick with someone in that situation after putting up with the nasty drunk for a tour or two.
And it does seem like Pete Willis really butted heads with Mutt Lange, which I think didn't help his situation, probably.
No, and again, you know, it's really hard to know without Pete kind of presenting his side of the story. You know, maybe Def Leppard needs to make some kind of monster sort of documentary and get themselves a therapist and sit down and make peace with Pete. But, you know, they've made peace with him. And hopefully, if nothing else, he's at peace with himself. Because here we are talking about an album that he was involved in and singing its praises 35 years on about how amazing the work is that he has contributed to.
Yeah. And you look at it, I mean, a lot of people probably think, well, you know, he sure must regret that after he's out of the band, then they become this massive success. But on one hand, he makes it pretty clear he doesn't think he'd even be alive today if he stayed in the band. And also, you know, he still made plenty of money. His name's all over Pyromania. I'm sure he's got nice big checks. It's probably, I'm sure still to this day he gets so he definitely, you know, has been able to live comfortably, even though he didn't, you know, get to ride along on with the fame and everything they would go on to have. But, you know, it's not like he ended up destitute. You know, I'm sure he did quite well just with having his name attached to, you know, all the early albums and everything. So
hopefully he can look back at this album and smile.
So, yeah, that's High and Dry. Is there anything else you'd like to say, Julian, about the album or anything?
No, I would just, you know, remind everyone, just go put the album on, you know, and enjoy it. Because if you didn't like it then, you probably won't like it now. And if you loved it then, I'm pretty sure you'll still love it now. It's just one of those albums that I think doesn't age. It just, you know, it stays forever young. So I'm going to put it back on as soon as we're done here, and I'm going to smile for the next 42 minutes, guaranteed.
Yeah, if you're a fan of hard rock and heavy metal, it doesn't get any better than this. I mean, this is pretty much as good as it gets. So, all right, well, thank you so much, Julian, for talking to me about High and Dry. And, of course, any big Def Leppard fans out there should track down your book, Leppard Tracks, which is on Amazon and probably Barnes & Noble and everything, right?
Yeah, it's still up on Amazon, and there's a Kindle edition too. And I've been kicking around a second edition for a few years, but you know what? I doubt I'll ever get there. So go, you know, give it a look. Just remember, it's a bit schizophrenic, and it'll give you song stories. It'll give you some touring history, give you some set list of bootlegs, you know, a little bit of everything. It's a potpourri of Leppard.
Yeah, definitely. It's a very fun book for a big Def Leppard fan, for sure. All right, well, thanks so much, Julian, and so we're going to do another episode in the future about Zodiac Mind Warp, so we'll have you back on for sure, but thanks a lot for doing this.
I'll look forward to that, and hey, thanks a lot for having me on.
All right, can you please excuse the noise on stage for 1 minute? Thanks! So, Newcastle, how are you? How you been? All right! due to a long delay, it's been a long time, obviously. We at last have a new album out called High and Dry. There's one song from this one's called Another Hit and Run.
And now, to play us out.
What does that mean, to play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave you with a Def Leppard performance from the Reading Festival in 1980. This is a live performance of a song that at that time was called Medicine Man. And as you'll probably be able to tell, this song was eventually reworked and turned into the opening song on the next album we're going to talk about next week, Pyromania. So this is Medicine Man live in 1980 at the Reading Festival. Eventually it became Rock Rock Till You Drop. Till next time. We'll be right back.
I'll be back.
Oh,